Good evening, friends. Welcome. I'm Agnes Tan, and I'm a senior history major here at the college, and it's my privilege to welcome you here tonight to another Fugitives lecture. Tonight's lecture will be about 40 minutes long. I know that some of you have commitments and campus worship is going on, so feel free to slip out at the 40-minute mark if you have to. But if you can stay, we have 20 minutes more for questions, discussions, and perhaps arguments. Just a word about thanks to our sponsors. Fugitives is our on-campus chapter of ISI, Intercollegiate Studies Institute. Their goal is to educate students all across America on different campuses about traditions of liberty and conservatism. So they fund a lot of things that go on campuses, from Patrick Henry College to Harvard to Grove City, as well as we would also like to thank Center of Vision and Values, specifically their popular culture working group. Bet you didn't know they had one. And Lux Mea, and Fugitives. Yes, we have a lot of sponsors tonight to make this night happen. And we hope that you will also join us as we continue this lecture series throughout the spring, with this one starting it off and also three more to come. So tonight, to continue the conversation that we started last fall about pursuit of truth, goodness, and beauty, we talked a lot about leisure last semester, and this semester we thought it might be good to explore the goodness that is there in labor and work and learning and education, which a lot of us are called to right now here at Grove City. And here to start us off this evening is Dr. Drake. Dr. Drake received his PhD in musicology from the University of Glasgow, and the main focuses of his research include aesthetics, music criticism and appreciation, art history, late medieval literature, and congregational singing. Here at Grove City College, Dr. Drake teaches classes that help students to see the reward in knowing works of music well and the works of art well, in classes such as Civ Lit, Music Lit, Art History, and Church Music. I've sat in on taking a lot of these classes, and I hope that you might get the chance to as well. I am personally very excited to have this conversation because until I came to Grove City College, I don't know about you, but I had this image of art professors. I imagined that they lounged around all day drinking fine teas and fine wines. Well, not at Grove City, but being very laid back and chill. Work? Labor? That was the farthest thing I could think of when I thought about art. But I'm sure some of you who've taken Civ Arts might attest to this. Civ Arts is work. It's real labor. And that surprised me. But what surprised me even more was how sweet this labor could be. No one had ever shown me that labor and work could be this enjoyable and this good. And I'm glad to invite Dr. Drake here tonight to share more of that with us. So please welcome him.
That's a very kind introduction, and in many ways, perhaps even unfair, but you're awfully kind. And thanks to Fugitives and to other groups, to ISI, to Center for Vision and Values, and of course Lux Mea, for this kind invitation. I want to talk to you about laziness and about leisure, about labor. Those of us who were required to read it in our youth probably remember Mark Twain's description of labor in Tom Sawyer. Here I'm going to read a paragraph. Tom appeared on the sidewalk with a bucket of whitewash and a long-handled brush. He surveyed the fence, and all gladness left him, and a deep melancholy settled down upon his spirit. 30 yards of board fence, 9 feet high. Life to him seemed hollow, and existence but a burden. Sighing, he dipped his brush and passed it along the topmost plank, repeated the operation, did it again, compared the insignificant whitewashed streak with the far-reaching continent of unwhitewashed fence, and sat down on a tree box, discouraged. Jim came skipping out the gate with a tin pail and singing Buffalo Gals, bringing water from the town pump. It had always been hateful work in Tom's eyes before, but now it did not strike him so. Now, part of the humor of the paragraph comes from the way Twain exposes the hyperbole of our own minds. We laugh at it because we often share in Tom's sympathies and know that when we do, we think like a lazy boy. In the paragraphs that follow, millions of young American readers have been encouraged to praise the resourcefulness of just such a boy because he finds ways to shirk his whitewashing duties. I shouldn't like to dwell on the corrosive influences of Mark Twain because, of course, Twain celebrates a vice here that needs no influence to grow. The vice of laziness is something we all succumb to, and it's a pretty bad vice. It is the antagonist to both labor and leisure, though this is not always generally observed. I was invited, as a scholar who specializes in artifacts of leisure, to talk to you about the importance of labor. But I want to begin with that vice which works against both. Admit its charms up to a certain point, and then see how we might overcome it. Now, anyone with children knows that laziness tugs at our elbows even before we stop calling on them. And this is why Twain's scene works as well as it does. Were his character a full-grown man, we would be repelled by his indolence, as in measure we are by Dickens's Micawber, or Austen's Mary Musgrove, or Melville's Bartleby. Children are almost expected to be lazy. This is why the old schoolmasters drove boys to their lessons with a birch rod, just as oxen were driven to the field with a goad. Now, when I was a boy, corporal punishment was no longer used to correct laziness. I know this firsthand because I was lazy and was never whipped for it. In my day, the rod was reserved only for instances of gross misbehavior. Consequently, though my coevals are much less severe and probably less cruel than our grandparents, we are demonstrably more lazy. Notice that in bygone years, laziness was not reasoned out of children, but was treated almost like a bad habit. We used to dip the child's thumb in mustard to make him stop sucking it. We didn't lecture him on the expense of orthodontics. We used to whip the lazy boy, and although this was usually accompanied by a largely ignored truism about the importance of hard work, no one in those days relied on the truisms alone to convince. Now, it's not my purpose to condone or disparage that older practice, but only to point out something that it teaches us about laziness. Laziness appeals to reason. It was therefore corrected in children by brute force and not by reason, precisely because of this. Now, you may be surprised to hear me call laziness reasonable, because at first glance, the law of cause and effect seems to be all on the side of hard work. The proverb tells us that the sluggard does not plow in season. He therefore will seek at harvest and have nothing. He who does not work, we all know, shall not eat. Yes, but he who eats will soon be hungry again. It does not take even stupid children very long to see this cyclical problem. Children quickly note that the floor swept on a Friday will need to be swept again on a Saturday. That no sooner have they mastered first declension than they are hit with second declension. That if you put away the clean clothes, you will only be given the same clothes to put away again in a few days. The unwhitewashed fence, you'll note, seems a continent to Tom, as Virgil reminds us in the Gorgics. Erudit agricolis labor actus in orbem, atque in se sua per vestigia voluitur annus. The work returns to the laborer in a circle, like the year wants to walk back on itself. In other words, the thorns of the field and the sweat of the brow will be with us as long as this world endures. It is therefore no encouragement to tell a child, and only a little encouragement to tell an adult, that if he does not work, his job will never be finished. The child knows, and the adult knows even better, that his job will never be finished anyhow. If that job is at all unpleasant, and since the fall they all have been, its persistence is a strong motive to to laziness. Add to this rational motive any of the dozens of irrational ones, that our own job could be done 100 different and easier ways if only someone would let us do it thus, that someone else's job is certainly more pleasant than our own, that no one appreciates the hard work we put in. How is it, then, that laziness is to be overcome? Well, in primitive societies and in bygone times, I suspect it was overcome rather easily. Hunger makes a cruel scourge, indeed a crueler one than the birch rod. The labor necessary for survival is rarely so crushing that it isn't worth the effort. And the threat of boredom helps. Given the options of perpetual and difficult work or interminable idleness, many people prefer the first, just as many people today prefer an afternoon's walk in the hills to an afternoon measured out in coffee spoons. We seem also to have this persistent belief that any labor could be made easier if we gave a little care to how we went about it. And finally, there's the irrational but efficient motivation of greed. These last two motives led to the two things that relieved us from the worst bits of our labor, technology and pillaging. By the first, we made our own labor more fruitful and less burdensome. By the second, we came to avoid our own labor by stealing the fruits of others. Thanks to thousands of years of pillaging and technology and pillaging, many people's labor came to be rather less of a burden. The scourge of hunger became less and less threatening. In our own age and place, however, this has produced an unexpected side effect. If I were to cease from my labor at this very moment, and if, in time, my laziness made me hateful to my employer, my kin, and my church, my life would not yet end in starvation. Even if I were turned out on the streets, far from likely, given current housing laws, some well-meaning social worker would eventually, and probably quite rightly, diagnose me as mad and place me in an institution where all my mortal needs would be met. I would even be provided with entertainment there to protect me from my boredom. Provided that I could escape the clutches of greed, I could finish my years out in such an asylum with relative ease, punctuating my days with short walks down the hall to participate in arts and crafts. Again, I have no interest in condoning or disparaging the state of affairs. Treated as mere fact, however, we can see that it adds to a problem we met earlier. Where children are merely reasoned into labor, and adults know no real fear of want, neither training nor nature can safely guide us away from laziness. Training, with children or pets, depends a great deal on forming habits long before reason can, or indeed ever may, enter. And nature goads us with natural needs. Where those are partly removed, she can no longer easily sway us. Greed may yet drive us to industry, but that ugly motive is nearly the only one left to drive us. I say nearly, and for good reason. Yet show I unto you a more excellent way. In the third chapter of his letter to Colossians, St. Paul has a word for the Roman slaves who have converted to Christianity. He tells them, "Obey in everything those who are your earthly masters, not by way of eye service, as people pleasers, but with sincerity of heart, fearing the Lord. Whatever you do, work heartily, as for the Lord, and not for men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the inheritance as your reward. You are serving the Lord Christ." Now, none of us quite understands what it was like to be a slave in the late empire. On the one hand, slaves were costly, well-trained property who provided indispensable service to their masters. On the other hand, They were treated as dogs, were not even given rooms to lie in, but slept where they fell, and had very little appeal before the bar of the law. They were both better off and worse off than we might imagine, and of course, there was a range of mistreatment. What we can understand is their motivations. Karl Marx, and later Heidegger, might overemphasize the alienation that comes when modern man is distanced from the fruits of his labor. But in the Roman slave, alienation of this sort was surely perfectly achieved. The modern factory worker may make a product he cannot afford for a customer he cannot know, but he knows the value of the dollar he receives for his work, and he can at least use it as he pleases. Though hardly more enviable than the slave, the primitive savage at least had only hunger as his slave master, whereas the Roman slave worked to fill someone else's belly and could only eat when he was given leave to do so. The slave offers us a pure example of something that is partly mixed in every other case. Indeed, the errors of Marx and Heidegger come about because they imagine this admixture in pure form. But we need not run as far back in history to meet a mix of slavery and freedom when it comes to labor. I imagine we can see how it works in this very room. After this lecture ends, many of you all will go to a quiet place so that you can finish your reading assignments for tomorrow's classes. If I asked you why you did so, and you were careless as you answered, you might first answer, because it is required. If I press you, however, we could work backward from because it is required to because I signed up for the class to because it was required for my major, and then, well, because I wanted to study that subject, and finally, because I wanted to enroll at this college. We would find ourselves following a chain of very obvious voluntary actions. The slave's chain is shorter. He works because failure to do so would lead directly to the whipping post and then, if obdurate, to the cross. But though his chain is shorter, it is not so very different than ours at the end. Were we to take the line of inquiry back even farther, some might say, well, because everyone goes to college, although about that fact they are in fact in error. And then, well, because how could I get a job otherwise? And then, well, because I need to pay the rent. And then, because I'd be homeless and destitute. And then, because I would die. To which I would reply, my friend, that is a certainty, as much for you as it is for the Roman slave. In other words, left to our own even very good devices, we are all slaves to labor. Were we to pursue Aristotle's good life, to relinquish subordinate, secondary labors, and only work toward that blessed life of virtue and peace of mind, we would find ourselves working even then for seven mistresses of the most severe expectations. The cardinal virtues make for diligent taskmasters. And that labor would last but 70 years, at best. Now, it's just on this point that St. Paul's admonition is most helpful, though this isn't clear at first glance. May I remind you that Paul says, and here I quote, "Obey in everything those who are your earthly masters, not by way of eye service as people pleasers, but with sincerity of heart, fearing the Lord. Whatever you do, work heartily, as for the Lord and not for men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the inheritance as your reward. You are serving the Lord Christ." Does Paul not merely substitute one problem for another here? I mean, our problem, put simply, is this. We are tempted to laziness because we see that our work is ultimately not going to do us very much good. At best, it is the necessary activity to prolong an already fleeting existence. At worst, it is poured out like water through our fingers for the sake of a cruel slave master or boss. Does it make matters better to discover that this labor, whether for our slave master or ourselves, is really done for yet another master about whom we know even less? Were we reading the text in Greek, we might see the difficulty more plainly, because Paul's word for earthly masters is, and his word for the Lord, here are the same. Waked with a kick from sleep in the corner of a villa, the slave was jolted into a day of fetching and running, bowing and scraping and groveling, of snatching scraps of food as they fell to him, and hoping that he could avoid the ill temper of his master until he might collapse again into the same corner for a scant night's sleep. Is this lot any way improved by being told that it is all done for an invisible being beyond the clouds who will offer us an inheritance about which we know even very little? And what of your labor? Is it very much better? You scrape together what passes for an education these days, motivated by goodness knows what cocktail of social, parental, pecuniary, or scholarly motives. You then enter a workplace not at all eager for your arrival. You sit in a gray cubicle all day, filling out forms that seem to be the very archetype of redundancy and waste. You then make your hour commute home through choking traffic in order to piece a meal together and fritter away a few hours before sleep transports you instantaneously into another identical day. Does St. Paul mend matters for you very much by telling you that you are serving Christ with your pencil pushing, your form filling, and your sycophancy to the boss at the water cooler? The ox is no happier pulling a cart full of gold than he is pulling a cart full of lead. In either case, the driver's whip stings just as much. Happily, we are not all oxen. Man has the advantage, or here's the danger, the disadvantage, of being able to think about his work. He's encouraged when that work seems especially fruitful for himself or others he cares about. In the case of the slave, the work is never directly fruitful for himself or anyone he loves. It is merely the only way to avoid death. But what if the slave had an interest in his master's property? What if, in fact, and here, bear with me, the property was as much his own as it was his master's? What if he loved his master? That's exactly what St. Paul is telling us here and elsewhere when he speaks of inheritance. He mentions it several times in the same letter and its parallel one to the Ephesian church. There, we are told that Christ is the guarantee of our inheritance and that we have obtained it already. Slaves aren't used to being told this. By law, they couldn't inherit much and certainly could not inherit from their masters. But the news is even better than that. The inheritance about which Paul speaks will last forever. Labor, by becoming not our own but Christ's, is given a permanence. I don't think this permanence is merely because of the promise of life after death. My labor would not be much sweeter for knowing that it would end in a second life, per se. I might as likely be encouraged to discover, as the Stoics believed, that my labor would soon end in oblivion. I think what Paul means when he tells us they're working for Christ is that we are already participating in Christ's general labor of redemptive history. That is, we are part of a larger event of humanity and its selective reconciliation to God. This also means that the fruit of our labor, while not exactly our own, is at least assured. Let me explain by means of a few illustrations. Many of you enjoy watching football games, but perhaps you've had to miss an important one because of a prior commitment. Perhaps you've then gone back to watch the same football game, though you know your team won, and you even heard about a few key plays thanks to well-meaning friends who wanted to spoil it for you. The experience of watching that game later is very different than the white-knuckled breath-holding that you would have had if you'd been in the stadium and watched it live. I won't say that the rerun is without pleasure, but it is a different kind of pleasure. It's the pleasure of seeing how things will work out in detail, though you know how they will work out overall. It's the pleasure of vicariously participating in the slow but inexorable process that led to your team's victory. Now, though it would be impossible, can you imagine what it would be like to play in such a rerun? Well, our labor is a bit like that. We cannot at all imagine what part we'd have to play in that game. Well, we may never know that, even when the game's over. No doubt it will be a very small and brief part. Yet, we all know how it goes with games. I mean, there's no telling what small and brief event will make the difference. Any little sequence of events, I mean, even the mere passing of a few seconds on the clock, can be the one thing that mattered most. I have a friend who likes to remind me that my job is to slow the church's capitulation to popular culture. That is, I'm trying to run out the clock. Right? In a sense, Christianity asks us to think of our labor as a bit like a dance. Now, here I don't mean at all the freeform gesticulations of popular experience. Think of a great formal ball. Perhaps you've seen something like it in the movies set in the 18th or 19th centuries, where dancers move across the floor according to steps that they've known since they were school children. They all move as if one large organism, and yet with distinct and very beautiful individuals in it. Any one dancer, while dancing, can hardly tell what it is that the group is making together. Indeed, he can hardly tell very well what he is doing at all. I mean, he hasn't got time to think about it, really. He mainly has to focus on the music and his steps. I can almost imagine a sulky individual not wishing to participate because he could hardly see what was in it for him or even what was in it for anybody else. We all remember what Caroline Bingley said about how it would surely be more rational if conversation rather than dancing made the order of the day. Now, such a person might prefer to stand against the wall and talk over the music. In a sense, though I pity her, I can understand her too. There's no doubt that the dance takes a great deal of energy from all its participants. And yet, viewed from above in the galleries, or even from one side of the room, the sight's glorious. Anyone with a view of the whole ballroom, even in the eye of his imagination, feels that to sit it out is really bad form. Much more rational, but it would not be near so much like a ball. The effort is surely worth it. It's worth it because the creation of the dance as a whole is so lovely that any amount of individual sacrifice seems insignificant in the face of it. In a sense, it would be better to be a clumsy dancer who's getting on with his steps badly but as best he can than to be a sullen wallflower whose very presence is only an obstacle for everyone to dodge as they careen across the dance floor. And every now and again, out of the corner of the eye, one sees the whole thing come clear and has a sense for the whole purpose of it all. Then, though the steps are no less easy, and in isolation may even seem silly, their very difficulty makes them significant, and their very silliness makes them more fun. And that is what our labor is really like. In fact, after reading scripture about this subject, one begins to believe that the precise kind of labor is much less relevant than that we do it under the Lord. Remember that Paul tells the Corinthian slaves not to worry that they're slaves. His general rule is for everyone to remain as he is. This is why Christian societies have generally treated all licit labor as equal in importance, if not equal in wages. Our own society no longer believes this, of course. We idolize academically credentialed vocations, irrespective of their increasingly low wage. Dropping out of college is seen as a moral failure. And we just think about that for a minute, right? Think about what it would be like if you had to tell your parents you were dropping out of college. Now, admit to me that it doesn't feel like a moral failure in your minds. And then find the Bible verse whereby you would support that moral failure, right? How would you do it? Maybe you could, by appeals to laziness, but no other way, right? Our society is confused in this matter. Dropping out of college is seen as a moral failure. And we all but ensure that whoever attempts to earn an academic credential will achieve it, howsoever ill-suited or ill-equipped he may be. It's as if we believe that every musician were to play cello, or that only the dancers wearing trousers were of any use. Of course, one can't press the metaphor too far, because in labor, something happens that never really happens in a ball. Some people labor without having any idea that their work is part of a much larger purpose, whereas nobody really dances in such ignorance. God seems to allow some people to labor their whole lives and yet forget what it is that we're all doing together. Indeed, without a care, any of us can forget that our work, even when taken on the level of natural law, is always part of something larger. We forget that when we build bridges, we allow someone else the chance to visit his grandmother across the river. We forget that when we practice accounting, we prepare the taxes for a farmer who's grown food more efficiently than ever we could, though he's no good at taxes. We forget that when we study languages, we do so in order to translate a book for the plumber who likes Virgil but can't read Latin. He can't read Latin, well, because he spent time learning how to fix a toilet so that we wouldn't have to fix our own. He doesn't want us to have to fix our own because he wants us to translate Virgil for him, a task he is less suited to. The real fruit of our labor is not vegetables or fixed toilets or legible Aeneids. The real fruit of our labor is our happy participation in the whole dance. That is how labor works, even on the natural level. There is, however, a higher level. As we dance, I hope, some of us gladly look out of the corner of our eye when we can to him who watches and keeps time. This part is not only easy to forget, I think it's almost impossible to think of, were God himself not eager for us to notice. We need his regular assurance that the dance is in fact an eternal one that pleases an eternal choreographer who has an eternal reward for those who dance for him. And that reward begins now. Christ can baptize all our labors by setting our hearts on the one for whom we actually work. Tom's Aunt Polly only demands a whitewashed fence, but our master won't be content until all our labor has been washed whiter than snow. Now, I think we have time for some questions. So, any questions on that topic? Right. Well, I was very careful not to overemphasize what I think everyone thinks of when they think of invisible inheritance. They think of heaven, streets of gold, eternal life, the blessed existence with our Lord forever, right? Of course, that is guaranteed. That is part of the inheritance. I think Paul is very quick to point out that in both the passage I quoted from, but also a parallel idea in the letter to the Ephesians. I mean, the two epistles track in interesting ways. That he tells us that inheritance is coming, and it's also now, right? That that the invisible inheritance is, in fact, invisible because it's very hard for us to see to what degree we participate in the broader work of redemptive history. It's very hard for us to even understand how some slight kindness today or some moderate achievement of engineering or some development of some small and petty idea might lead to some very useful affair that makes maybe the life of someone else much more comfortable, makes them much more at their leisure to investigate Scripture or to think about God or serious things, and then on we go. That's an invisible inheritance too, and I think Scripture is pretty clear about that taken as a whole. This is why I think that is far more of a comfort to us in the here and now than this promise of I think we have to admit a less than clear notion of that which is to come. Well, I think that's maybe the thesis of Ecclesiastes, right? I mean, I think that taken as a whole, it's a very hard book to make sense of it in pieces because the preacher speaks out of both sides of his mouth as the whole thing progresses. And then eventually I think we get the gist of the book, which is very much that we're to delight in the labor that we're given because, of course, man can has eternity in his heart, but he can't see from the beginning of and the end what the plan is, you know, and that's Ecclesiastes. Yeah.
It's about raising children, teaching them to work, and how reason doesn't always work, and so sometimes your parents they resort to brute force. How much do you think that children can understand work as their participation in the Great Plans? Are there specific ways that can help your children see that?
Right. It's much harder for them. This is one of the reasons why it becomes much less like a rational appeal to them, because it requires a kind of abstraction, which children are not especially good at, right? They're not especially good at stepping back from whatever petty task you've set to them and being grateful to live in a house that's clean or a room that's tidy. They don't think about that, you know, and they maybe can't, right? That's why I think that while we tell them again and again how important it is to be part of all this, that there are other ways by which we help them to their labors, which tend to be more successful. But having said that, I mean, I think I found it helpful to find the kinds of labor that they can see through to an end, right? To see finished, right? It's very helpful because it undermines one of the early appeals I pointed to laziness, which is that the work never seems finished, right? It's just there's always more of it. But children, because they're not very good at abstract thinking, sometimes don't even get that far. They sometimes don't see that it isn't finished. It feels very finished to them in that 30-second moment, right? It feels very complete, right? Especially if they're awfully young, and they're awfully proud of themselves for having achieved this temporary victory, which will ultimately be gone in moments, right? That may be good enough at that instant, because in the end it's a moral battle, right? It's they have to practice that kind of overcoming of laziness again and again and again, and eventually they can be baited by reason too, you know.
Yeah. Dr. Dick, to what extent do you think that specialization of labor is good? I started when you were talking about like the man who fixes the toilet. And he sort of exchanges that work for the translation of Virgil. A very beautiful picture. Yet at the same time, I've had a professor in years past that pointed out, for example, like the German system of education that's super specialized. Yeah. And he pointed out a lot of things that we lose as a society.
Right.
So what do you think a good measure is in specialization?
I'd like to divide your question into two sections, because you crossed terms on me there from labor and education, which may not be quite the same idea. And I think it's important to see that they're not. It's a very good point. I'm increasingly concerned with the specialization of education, especially when education stops being education and starts being training, right? It's a wonderful thing to train for a particular job. That's very important, especially if you're going to do it. I hope my cardiologist has a great deal of it, right? There's nothing wrong with that. And I hope that he spent a lot of time in special training, right? It wouldn't be good enough for him to be a general practitioner if he's going to split my chest open. I'm hoping for more, right? So that kind of specialization of training is very important to particular tasks. And I think that a society that doesn't allow for it fails in many ways. It just has to be the case. But of course, education is a different matter, right? I mean, and I think that when we can see the two as separate, right, then I think we can see that education is the sort of thing that benefits all the people that can be benefited from it. Now, that doesn't mean everybody. Many people cannot be educated past a certain point. They haven't the intellectual abilities to do so. They'll need to wait till glory when the encumbrances of this fallen mortal frame and the mind which comes with it are overcome, right? So many people cannot be educated at any number of levels, right? But our society muddles all that, right? And then what we have are people who are not being educated at all, but being trained from the very earliest youth down a particular track, right? A track that they may not even be suited for, but they've set their heart on, right? And they, and they're down that track before they can even be pulled off of it, right? And they'll be encouraged along that track because of some notions of self-esteem or something, you know. So that's now, of course, I've muddled the answer, but I think my point is to take education out of it. Your initial question was about specialization of labor, to which I would say it's generally great, right? In other words, you might think to yourself, well, yeah, but I like to grow vegetables too, right? I shouldn't just leave it to the farmer to do that. As well, you might not. I think you should grow vegetables, right? But I wouldn't want to live in a society that had to live on my vegetables, right? Right? Because there wouldn't be enough of them. I want somebody whose special care has been to grow vegetables so that even if I don't buy them, why, the people who haven't enough money to buy locally sourced organic ones can have some kind of vegetables, right? You know what I'm saying? So I think labor is best when divided and focused. Education is, of course, something that advantages everyone, but in different degrees based on their giftedness. I think once we split those things up, I think it tidies up pretty well, right? And does that, I mean, can you see maybe how that...
You hit on a lot of the things that are...
Okay, right, yeah. It's more an issue of... there's more agreement here between the positions than it might seem at first, because the various sides of the discussion tend to come together, right? Yeah. Others. Was that where you were going? Okay, now.
So one of the things you talked about was kind of the circular nature of work. Right. You know, you clean your room, and then suddenly on Saturday, the room is clean.
Right, yeah,
you
sure.
Know, you wash
sure.
your clothes,
right.
Yet again on Tuesday, yeah. You must wash them again.
Right.
And I think in Chesterton's Orthodoxy, he talks about the same thing, and about mm-hmm. God taking joy, and do it again,
exactly, and yeah, yeah, lovely,
I really
yeah.
I have a good question on that.
It's a really good reminder that this is not particularly novel, what I'm saying here. In other words, our participation in the labor is becomes delectable, not because it's something that at some point ceases. It doesn't cease, right? It becomes delectable because it's apparent that it's more than what it seems. And then actually the very silliness of it makes it kind of fun, right? That's what, I mean, if we don't develop a kind of laughter toward nature in that regard, almost a buffoonery about it, why we're off to a very sad life, because labor is full of patent absurdity, right? It's just all these, I mean, all day long, all of us do things that we think, well, this is just busy work, or this is just bureaucracy, or this is irrelevant, or this is achieving no good at all. And of course it's not. It's human labor, right? What did you think it was? Angels, right? I mean, of course it's absurd. Of course it's got this tomfoolery built into it. That's what makes it kind of fun and cute, like a dance, right? Where we're tripping and laughing and, you know, and a little bit hot and a little bit sweaty, you know, but it's okay. You know, this is what labor's like. So I think do it again is exactly it. And when we see it like that, it's much more handsome, you know.
the point that it's because of the fall that it's this cyclical labor?
Yeah.
So in a sense, isn't it bad? It's not that we should not work, but...
Right. Well, that's something I need to address, because that's something that feels like a hole that isn't. So God is going to redeem that fall. He's going to make good out of it, right? He's going to work it towards something, right? That doesn't make it not a fall, but it doesn't make it as doesn't make it the sort of thing that we have to mope about, right? There's that passage in Milton where Adam says to Eve, well, what better can we do than repairing to the place where we fell, kneeling prostrate? Surely the answer is, of course, is not to just sit around with our, you know, head in our hands in our hair. Oh, we've fallen, right? Oh, no, right? The answer is, well, let's see what he'll do with this, right? And, of course, we know what he'll do with it, right? The seed of the woman will crush the serpent's heel. I mean, it's a foregone conclusion. Right? So I think that you're right, and I hope that I haven't minimized the reality of difficulty and labor by treating it with a kind of jocularity, right? That it's the sort of thing that we have to admit that's hard, but I think even the hardness of it can also be a bit fun. I don't know about you, but I enjoy a good sweat. And thorns are very satisfied when they're pulled up. Very satisfying. I mean, it's just the most pleasant thing, right? So there is a sense in which even that is redeemable, you know? It doesn't make it a fall to say that it's a fall that can be redeemed from, right? At all. It doesn't make it not a fall, I should say, yeah. Yeah. Well, here I'm out of my depth. I mean, I don't know. You know what I mean? But I have often assumed that I will have something to do in heaven. That my worship will involve labor. And I assumed that because Adam's life involved labor before the fall, right? That he was not put in a garden merely to worship God in the most direct Sabbath way, but he was put in a garden to tend and keep it, right? That he was given, even there, a cycle of days where he'd labor and even, we assume, maybe have leisure on that day of rest which the Lord himself sanctioned, right? So I tend to think that we would work, that work would involve some kind of temporal, non-temporal cycle, you know? I mean, obviously we haven't a sun or moon, so it's hard to keep time. But, you know, yeah. Maybe one, two more here. Other questions? Yeah.
Early on in your talk, you presented labor and laziness as kind of antithesis, which makes sense. But how does it play into today's culture where, due to technology and specialization, we only need to work 40 hours and 160 hours?
And thanks for giving me a chance to clear that up. Laziness is the antithesis not just to labor, but also to leisure. We're in an age that gives us the opportunity to have a richer mixture of labor and leisure than other times in history, at least for now. Anything could happen. We might find ourselves in a very different age here in 50 years. But for now, we have this rich mix of these two things. And neither labor or leisure, nor leisure, have to involve laziness at all. Right? They can be done with diligence, with our whole heart, and so forth. So I think that's it's one of the nice things about our age is that we can have a little bit of rest as well as work in opposition to laziness. You know? So. Good. All right. Thanks a lot.